From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The massacre last week in a West Bank mosque has jeopardized the Middle East peace talks. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Milton Viorst about the ongoing conflicts between Jewish settlers and Palestinians in the occupied territories. Viorst has covered the Middle East for The New Yorker and is the author of the new book Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World. Also, stand-up comic and actress Janine Garofalo. She's a regular on The Larry Sanders Show and co-stars in the new movie Reality Bites. And commentator Gail Pemberton reflects on Black History Month, which ends today. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. NATO warplanes moved this morning to enforce the no-fly zone over Bosnia's war zone. Two U.S. F-16 fighter jets shot down four Serbian planes after they ignored warnings to land. The Serbian planes are being blamed for bombing the town of Begunja and a munitions factory in southern Bosnia. The BBC's Martin Dawes has more.
A local policeman on duty near the factory saw the Serb tricolour on one of the planes as it flashed by. There are now reports that the aircraft first attacked a target at the Bosnian-held town of Begunje to the southwest before rocketing the arms factory at Novi Travnik. Details of the first attack are scarce, but at the factory there were no casualties. One of the guards said nine rockets were fired. Most fell short, hitting an oil tank and a machinery room. The oil fire was still making a thick plume of smoke hours after the attack. The Bosnian Serbs are known to possess Galab jets, which are mainly based at Banja Luka, near where the aircraft are said to have been shot down. The Bosnian Serbs are denying responsibility, but a senior Bosnian army commander in the area, Hamed Mesinovic, is clear about what he thinks was the motivation for the attack. It was, he said, a clenched fist at the West.
The BBC's Martin Dawes reporting. This is the day the Brady Gun Control Act became law, mandating a five-day waiting period for the purchase of guns. Former White House Press Secretary Jim Brady used the day to announce a nationwide push for new gun control legislation.
Today, the Brady Law is the law of the land. And today, I begin the campaign for Brady II. A comprehensive legislative plan to end America's epidemic of gun violence.
The new legislation would add nationwide gun licensing and registration requirements. President Clinton, who is spending part of the day in Chicago, used the occasion to urge Congress to pass a tough anti-crime measure.
We know this brings crime down. It is already beginning to work. In Chicago, it will work dramatically if we can give the men and women who are working on our streets the support they need. The crime bill will do that. 100,000 more police officers on the street, and we need to pass it as soon as possible.
The president, as he has done in the past, linked the drive for anti-crime legislation with health care. The State Department says the United States has issued a strong protest over Russia's expulsion of an American diplomat. Russia says the move was in retaliation for the U.S. expulsion of one of its diplomats last week. That was in connection with the CIA spy case. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 5.5 points. It stands at 38.33. This is NPR News in Washington. The Associated Press reports that Roman Catholic Cardinal Joseph Bernardine is no longer a defendant in a sexual abuse suit. Stephen J. Cook of Philadelphia had filed a $10 million suit, accusing Bernardine of abusing him during the 1970s. But Cook now says he realizes his memories of the alleged abuse are not reliable. South African President F.W. de Klerk is appealing to right-wing groups to avoid violence before April's democratic elections. De Klerk spoke today before an emergency parliamentary session, which is to approve political concessions to the right wing. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
De Klerk said the concessions due to be passed this week should meet the demands of Zulu nationalists and Afrikaner separatists, but both groups have already said that Parliament's actions will not persuade them to abandon a boycott of the elections. Meanwhile, government and African National Congress officials continue private efforts to bring the right wing into the campaign. Tomorrow, ANC President Nelson Mandela meets Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi in a bid to get Buthelezi's predominantly Zulu party into the elections. Buthelezi has said he will not take part unless further changes are made, giving the apartheid homeland of KwaZulu a large degree of political autonomy after the elections. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
The United States and Vietnam have opened their first major political and financial talks in more than 20 years. Meetings are being held in Hanoi. Negotiations are initially aimed at resolving U.S. financial claims dating back to the end of the Vietnam War. The two countries may also agree to open liaison offices in each other's capitals. NASA is counting down to another shuttle launch. Columbia is scheduled to blast off on Thursday with a crew of five. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It is unclear whether the Middle East peace process will be one of the casualties of Friday's massacre in Hebron. On Friday, Dr. Baruch Goldstein, an extremist Jewish settler in the West Bank, shot down Palestinian Muslims praying at a mosque. About 40 Palestinians were killed. Over 20 people have died in rioting that followed the massacre. The PLO says it won't return to the table unless Israel disarms the settlers. Israel says that is an unacceptable condition. My guest Milton Viorst has written about the Middle East for The New Yorker magazine. His 1987 book Sands of Sorrow, Israel's Journey from Independence, was critical of Israel. His new book Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World, casts a critical eye on the Arab world for its secular and religious despotism. I asked Viorst about his personal reaction to the massacre.
Well, it's hard not to be appalled. Of course I'm appalled and shocked and overwhelmed by the magnitude of this tragedy. But it doesn't come, alas, as a terrible surprise. I mean, we've all known about terrorists, and we all know that there are terrorists on both sides of the fence on this question. And there is a deep sense of entitlement, not just by these Jewish extremists, but by an entire community out there. And they really believe that the Arabs have no business in this land, although they've inhabited it without interruption for a couple of thousand years, that the Bible entitles them so strongly to take it over that there is no questioning it, even though there are a lot of people in the region who don't for whom the Bible is not the first source of religious or real estate authority. And it's just a terrible thing that you can believe in your own cause so deeply, I think, that you would that one would engage in an act of this sort. And what is so shocking is that it obviously has the support, as we have seen, of a lot of Dr. Goldstein's friends and supporters.
How typical do you think Goldstein is of the settlers in the territories?
Well, there are 130,000 settlers. Of those, perhaps 100 or 110,000 are people who moved out there because the government gave them tax breaks, and it was very advantageous to do so. But the whole thing began with the handful and finally grew into 10 or 15 or 20,000 who went out there because of a deep ideological conviction that this is what Zionism and Israel was all about. This was, as they say, King David never lived in Tel Aviv. He lived up in the mountains, and he lived in and around Jerusalem and Hebron. So they say this is more important to Zionism than is the coastal area, where the real concentration of the Jewish population is.
Do you see the massacre as the action of a lunatic, or more as the inevitable outcome of Israel's former encouragement of settlers in the occupied territories?
Well, it is the work of a lunatic. I don't think that former Prime Minister Begin would ever come out and say, yes, we have to massacre people. But nonetheless, there is a body of ideology which the Likud government under Menachem Begin made extremely popular. It became a guiding light after the Six-Day War of 1967, when so many Israelis began to think that this was a statement by God endorsing, authorizing the expansion of Israel. There was a whole shift in Orthodox thinking in Israel after the Six-Day War. prior to that, the religious orthodoxy held that an Israeli government was a secular government, and we are waiting for the Messiah, and we're not interested in secularism. We are religious people. Suddenly, after the Six-Day War, they shifted and said, well, this is God's signal showing us that we must take over the whole land. And so the thrust of Orthodox ideology shifted, and these fellas are out there as the gunmen. They're doing the job.
Do you think it's hard to change the attitudes of militant settlers after they've been encouraged to go out there? In other words, just because government policy changes and there's a peace process underway, would you expect that people who are ideologues and extremists would change too?
No, it's going to be very hard to get these people back into the box. What happened is that Begin opened this jack-in-the-box thing. They came out, getting them back, saying that the government has shifted policy again, and we are now discouraging settlements because our policy is to make peace with the Palestinians. We regard that as far more important to Israel and to the future of our state, some position I agree with, of course. But these people do not agree with that. They think that peace is a secondary concern. Their definition of peace is driving the Arabs out, subduing the Arabs, making sure they are no longer in a position to continue the conflict. That's peace. They don't have any notion of compromise. There are times in every society's history, I suppose, when the most inflammatory people, the most fanatical people, prevail. And for a while, they were prevailing. The movement is against them now. The tide has turned. They know that. And that's the source of such desperate acts as took place in Hebron.
What Israel has done so far since the massacre includes, for the first time, the army has closed off Jewish settlements in predominantly Palestinian Hebron. It's created a commission to investigate the massacre. It plans for the release of up to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. The army has issued orders for the immediate administrative detention of 5 settlers presumed to be members of the militant Koch party. And the government may take guns away from about 20 other militant settlers. Arafat has said that what Israel has done so far is really a collection of empty, hollow gestures. What would the PLO like to see Israel do in response to the massacre?
Well, what I guess the PLO would like is to see some steps that will end the Jewish settlements in the West Bank. I think that much of Israel now, and certainly the Palestinians, recognize that the presence of all of these Jewish settlers, and I'm talking about those I called the commuters before, as well as the militants, is not compatible with Palestinian rule over the territory. There are 600,000 or 700,000 Arabs living in Israel. So presumably there is something of a mirror image. And one could say, well, if you have all of these Arabs in Israel, why not have the Jews under Palestinian rule? Except the Arabs in Israel acknowledge the sovereignty of the Israeli government. They are not challenging it. They live under it. They pay taxes. They vote. They go to schools. They live in peaceful and harmonious relations with the Israeli government. The settlers in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip operate under a totally different ideology. They are there in order to govern. They are there in order to rule. They have made very clear, there is no doubt about this, this is not any revelation. This is based upon their own statements. They are there to assure that the Palestinians cannot take over the territories. They feel that this territory has got to be under Jewish rule. And as long as they are there, it is unimaginable that the Palestinians can run a successful political administration because you have 130,000 of the enemy right there in your midst. And if they are being safeguarded by the Israeli army, no matter how much the Israeli army's presence is reduced, it still makes it inconceivable, in my judgment, that the Palestinians can run a successful administration, and to show that they can govern themselves, which is what the whole point of the transition from through the autonomy process is all about. I think that Israel this is a warning to the Israelis, and many, as I say, many Israelis know this, that they have got to put an end to the settlements.
The issue of Jewish settlements wasn't supposed to really come up in the peace talks till about two years from now. And the Palestinians are saying this has to be addressed immediately.
Well, the politics, the internal politics of Israel, because the settlers movement has grown so great, has gotten out of hand, because Begin, in a sense, was vindicated by now having 130,000 Israelis living in the territories, they have become a very powerful political force, and an even grossly disproportionately powerful political force, because their threat of violence intimidates all Israelis. No Israelis want civil war between Jews and Jews. That's quite understandable. So as long as these people out in the territory say, if you really attempt to take these territories away from us, you are risking a war of Jews against Jews. So Rabin has been frightened by this. Any political leader might very well be frightened about this. I think in his heart of hearts, Rabin has a certain sympathy for them, except I think he also is practical enough to understand that that their position is untenable if Israel is to survive over the course of the future in some sort of reasonable relationship with its neighbors. But the fact is that they are so powerful that Rabin decided he wasn't going to take them on. Let's get some sort of agreement signed with the Palestinians. Let's get the process going. And two, three, four years from now, we'll see what the situation is with the settlers. And I think that what this episode indicates is that's naive, because the settlers are so committed to stopping the entire process, reversing the entire process of peacemaking, that it will be impossible to put the issue off for another few years.
When you talk about civil war, are you talking about the possibility of Jews taking up weapons to fight other Jews in Israel over the issue of the territories?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's not my observation. They have said it themselves.
They being the settlers?
The settlers have said it, that if somebody, if the army comes in and tries to do anything, they will shoot down. Well, during the time of the negotiation of the peace treaty with Egypt, the settlers made the same threats to the Israeli army, and indeed did resist, although not very vigorously, but they did physically resist the dismantling of the settlements in the Sinai. There is the famous incident of Yamit, where they fought off the army. Nobody was killed, because mostly it was with stones and rocks and that sort of thing, but they fought off the army for days before they finally agreed to leave the territories, and they only finally agreed because they were there, because of their having been bought off with a huge amount of money. I think the same thing will probably be true for the settlers in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They will have to be bought off with a substantial amount of money, too.
What do you mean,
yes,
bought off by money?
Well, you give up your homes in the territories, and we will give you X shekels, yen, dollars, whatever it may be, to set up homes in Israel proper. But the settlers in Yamit, which was a small town set up after 1967 in the Sinai, made a huge amount of money from the Israeli, and absolutely outraging many Israelis, many unsympathetic Israelis, who saw this as extortion, and it was a form of extortion. Let's be honest with it. And many of the 130,000 who are out there now would be quite contented to go back to Israel proper, because they are not of an ideological bent. If they got enough money to justify their return, that means, let's say, comparable homes inside Israel proper. But the ideologues, this crowd that did the shooting over the weekend, feel that money is not the issue. I mean, what they are talking about is deeply rooted ideology. And I think it's quite possible that they will be willing to wage civil war against Israel, and they may very well have to be driven out by force, although maybe when the time comes, they'll back down. But so far, they're not backing down.
My guest is Milton Viorist. He's covered the Middle East for The New Yorker and has a new book called Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Milton Viorst. Goldstein, the gunman in the massacre, wanted to stop the peace process, and it looks like it's temporarily grinding to a halt. The PLO, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan have broken off from the peace talks, which were scheduled for this week. What are the pressures on the PLO to pull out and the pressures on the PLO to go forward?
Well, it's not, I don't think it's proper at this stage, at least, to see it in terms of pressures. I think both Israel and the PLO at this point have made a political slash strategic decision that that they're going to make peace with each other. Both sides are very uncomfortable. Neither side sees very clearly where this is all going, but both sides have acknowledged that the self-interest of themselves and their people requires them to make peace. That is not to say that peace should be mistaken for sellout. Clearly, Dr. Goldstein and his friends think Israel is selling out, and the Hamas people and many other Palestinians feel that the PLO is selling out. Nobody particularly likes the terms on either side. My sense, nonetheless, is that both sides are so totally committed to making peace that after some reasonable period of face-saving and stomping and jumping up and down and making clear how angry you are and, in a sense, basically gratifying the needs of the political opposition and within both camps in order to present some kind of semblance of consensus for the next stage, then the peace process will resume. It may take a few days. I don't think it's going to take more than a few weeks. I think they're probably going to get back to it.
Meir Kahane, the late Meir Kahane, who was the leader of the far right, or at least one of the leaders of the far right in Israel, is from Brooklyn, New York. And Goldstein, the killer in the massacre, he's from Brooklyn, New York, too. Do you have any idea of the strength of Jewish extremist groups in the United States now?
Well, they are very strong, but I think they're also very small. An awful lot of them have gone to Israel. I think if you go back and look at the history, the Jewish Defense League was formed to defend Jewish neighborhoods against blacks, whom they felt were besieging them. They were extremists then, and they have shifted gears and moved their activities largely to Israel and to the occupied territories, and now, of course, direct their activity against Arabs, conjuring up all of the terrible things that have ever happened to Jews over the course of centuries. I see that there are frequent statements in the press over the course of the past few days calling the Arabs Arab Nazis and Nazis. You know, the Arabs, one can criticize the Arabs for much if one wants to, but Nazis have nothing to do with it. There was never a Holocaust as long as Jews lived in the Arab world. It wasn't the happiest of marriages, but for over the course of 2,000 years or somewhere thereabouts, Jews and Arabs lived closely together and rather well. The problems between the Arab world and Israel and the Jews only arose with the politicization of the problem by when somebody said, well, we Jews will give up our communities in Damascus and Baghdad and elsewhere where they have lived since biblical times and concentrate in a land called Israel where we will set up our own sovereign state. That the Arabs found objectionable. They were unfamiliar with it. They didn't like it. They didn't want the Jews to do that. But when Jews lived among Arabs over the course of so many centuries, it was rather harmonious. And so when I see the Kahane people, the Dr. Goldstein people, referring to the Arabs as Nazis, as Begin did, it might be said, in order to arouse this kind of sentiment among the Jews of Israel. It really has no historical justification at all.
Has it been very difficult for you as a Jewish journalist to cover the Middle East and still be seen as being fair?
Well, sure. I was much criticized by the Jewish community in the United States for saying critical things about Israel. But my response to this, as much as we all hate to be criticized, I was a consenting adult. I knew what I was doing. And I made a decision that I would absorb this criticism if I had to, in order to write what I felt was necessary to write. Well, the same thing is probably true in the Arab world. It's a little bit different, I've got to say, because it's one thing to criticize your own people, and it's something else to criticize another people. I have already been accused a few times of being not being PC, of being ethnocentric. Somebody said there was a smell of racism about my book about the Arabs, but I deny that. I really feel as if I have applied the same standards of examination to the Arabs as I have to the Jews, and sometimes the result is not positive. And when it's not positive, I think, as a writer, I've got to say that.
What are the PC landmines that you have to deal with as a journalist covering the Middle East?
Well, I'm kind of interested in the big picture, if I can say that, and I take a very careful look at Islam, because I think Islam is the foundation of Arab civilization. And I don't say anything critical about Islam any more than I say anything critical about Judaism, because I think as a body of theology, I am not a theologian, but as a body of theology, they're both fine. It's who has taken over this body of theology, whether it be Judaism or Islam, and used it for the political purposes that they see they would like to achieve. And I think that just as Rabbi Kahana and his Orthodox colleagues have hijacked Judaism and made it into a right-wing political ideology, which I think there is little justification for, I think over the course of time, people have taken over Islam and made it into a highly restricted, highly limited dogma, which allows no room for intellectual exploration, for doubt, for challenge of orthodoxy. I mean, the West was like that 1,000 years ago, and we went through many, many bloody wars in order for the right of free thought to prevail, and basically it has, although there are certain people even within our society who would deny that right when they can. But that still hasn't taken place within the Arab world, and it's a significant problem for them.
For many years now, you've been talking to Israelis and to Arabs about the Middle East. Are there specific areas that you think both sides have blind spots about when thinking of the other?
Well, certainly both sides have blind spots about the past of the other. It is very hard to find an Arab who understands the depth of the feelings of the Jews about not only not having their own land, but what not having their own land has cost them in terms of the suffering they have experienced at largely Christian, not Arab hands. So I think that it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard for one people to put their thinking processes, their sympathy, their sympathetic examination into the minds of another. Well, the same thing is certainly true of the Jews in dealing with the Arabs. The Arabs have had a difficult and complex history. They have suffered a great deal at the hands of many peoples. I would argue that much of it may very well be their own responsibility, but be that as it may, I think it is incumbent upon Jews to make some sort of effort to understand what the Arabs are about.
Milton Vioris is the author of Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, stand-up comic, actress, and self-proclaimed underachiever Janine Garofalo. Somehow her success hasn't caught up with her. She plays the caustic casting agent on The Larry Sanders Show and was a regular on The Ben Stiller Show. Now she's starring in Ben Stiller's new film comedy, Reality Bites. And this underachiever is not yet 30. Also, commentator Gail Pemberton has a modest proposal about Black History Month. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Clinton says today's downing of four Serbian planes in Bosnia by U.S. F-16 fighters was necessary to keep the war in Bosnia from moving to the air. The president said the planes had violated a NATO-patrolled no-fly zone, were engaged in a bombing mission, and had been warned to land before they were shot down. The president said helicopters have violated the no-fly zone, but this is the first time fixed-wing aircraft have done so. Russia says it supports NATO's downing of the planes, but the Yeltsin government is calling for an investigation of the incident. Brooke Gladstone has the story from Moscow.
The Russian Foreign Ministry said today that whoever carried out the military sortie over Bosnia in violation of the Security Council resolutions on the no-fly zone, it is they who bear full responsibility for what happened. That according to the official Itar TASS news agency. But Russia intends to seek out the identity of the violators and reports that the Bosnian Serb High Command has denied responsibility. Moreover, Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic arrived in Moscow late today for talks with Russian officials. I am here to ensure the peace process, he told reporters at Moscow's Sheremetyevo airport. Russia will help us. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
Strong protests from the State Department today after Russia expelled a U.S. embassy official from Moscow. The State Department called that an act of unjustified retaliation, but says the U.S. does not plan to retaliate. The Russian action followed last week's U.S. move expelling a Russian from Washington. He was said to be connected to the CIA spy scandal. The judge in the murder trial of Michael Griffin has ruled the defense will be allowed to introduce anti-abortion material as evidence. Griffin is charged with shooting to death Dr. David Gunn outside his Florida abortion clinic last year. Debbie Elliott reports.
In his opening statement, prosecutor James Murray said the state will present physical evidence and several eyewitnesses to prove that 32-year-old Michael Griffin was hiding near Pensacola Women's Medical Services last March 10th. Ran across a parking lot, and then shot David Gunn three times in the back using a revolver he had borrowed from his father 2 months prior. The assistant state attorney also plans to present testimony from police officers and a jailer who said Griffin admitted he shot Dr. Gunn. Griffin's lawyer, Bob Kerrigan, told jurors that the state has no evidence to prove that Griffin planned to kill someone. Premeditation is necessary for a first-degree murder conviction. During his opening remarks, Kerrigan also described the graphic anti-abortion material he will introduce to show what Griffin was exposed to by a local abortion opponent. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down 6.75 points in heavy trading. This is NPR in Washington. Roman Catholic Cardinal Joseph Bernardine is no longer a defendant in a sexual abuse lawsuit. Stephen Cook of Philadelphia filed the $10 million suit, but he now says he realizes his memories of the alleged abuse by the Chicago Cardinal were not reliable. They surfaced during and after hypnosis. A report by the UN's International Narcotics Control Board describes a dramatic worsening of global drug problems over the past two decades. The report examines the world drug scene and international compliance with UN drug control treaties. Linda Fasulo reports.
The 1993 report says that international drug cartels are enjoying growing political influence and economic power, and confirms increased internationalization and cooperation among the cartels, with trafficking groups bartering different drugs among themselves and using each other's trafficking routes. The study also shows drug traffickers are becoming more violent and ruthless in securing full control of the drug trafficking chain, from cultivation to distribution to money laundering. The report also says evidence points to traffickers' involvement in illegal arms sales and links to subversive political groups. In addition to heroin and cocaine abuse, the International Narcotics Control Board cites increasing worldwide abuse of synthetic stimulants such as amphetamine. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is asking Arabs to return to peace talks, which were suspended after last week's massacre at a mosque in the West Bank. But he has rejected PLO demands to move ahead negotiations on getting rid of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. The Brady gun control measure took effect today. Among other things, it mandates a 5-day wait before buying a gun. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The film Reality Bites is being billed as a comedy about Generation X. Co-star Janine Garofalo refuses to be in the position of spokesperson for her generation. But you can tell from her stand-up act that being in her 20s has affected her view of the world. Here she is on The Dennis Miller Show.
2.5 low-maintenance cum type of gal. You know, don't push me on this. I have never in my life uttered the phrase, is there going to be extra credit on this? You know, because I'd never do it. But as a consequence of this, I have, like, no math skills at all. I have no educational skills. What am I going to do, God forbid, if one of my children comes at me with their math homework? God forbid, again, I have children. All right? Don't judge me for being barren. I admit I cried at the end of parenthood, too. All right, when all the babies were being born, I cried because I knew I would never know the joy of childbirth with Ron Howard directing. But be that as it may, if my son ever comes out with his math homework, I'll be like, why don't you just look in the back of the book, honey? Or, little friends, what your father and I always did. And what are you actually doing your work? Shouldn't you be up in your room smoking or watching a Van Damme film right about now?
Janine Garofalo has had the good luck and good judgment to co-star in two very funny TV shows. She plays a talent booker on The Larry Sanders Show, Gary Shandling's send-up of late-night talk shows. And she was a regular on the short-lived but highly acclaimed Ben Stiller Show. Her new film, Reality Bites, was directed by Stiller. It's about a group of friends who've just graduated from college and are trying to figure out what to do with their lives. Winona Ryder plays the class valedictorian who's making a video documentary about her friends. I'll let Garofalo describe her character.
Well, the character of Vicky is actually based on a real girl who is a friend of Helen Childers, the scriptwriter. And the real girl's name is July Peaches, who is like a child of parents who were acid head hippies. And she's like this... See, you actually, for me to describe the characters weird because they don't really go in depth with the character in the movie. So the character in the movie is just a girl who's obsessed with a 70s nostalgia and is very promiscuous and kind of lost until she gets this great job at The Gap, which defines her. So I guess that's a character description.
I haven't seen that much cigarette smoking in a movie in a really long time. People aren't allowed to smoke anywhere, and very few people smoke in movies now. And your
well, actually, it's back. It's made a big comeback.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, has it? Yeah?
Yes, I've noticed that it has.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also made a big comeback, from what I can see here in Los Angeles, with the young kids.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed, like, the young hipsters in coffee houses and stuff are just chain smoking.
Well, doesn't your character smoke on the Larry Sanders Show, too?
Yes. Yes, she does. Well, that's just because I smoke. I think they just let me smoke in that scene.
Your new movie, Reality Bites, is directed by Ben Stiller, who you worked with before on his TV show, the Fox TV show. How did you meet?
We met at Cantor's, which is a deli here on in Hollywood or Los Angeles. It was like 3 a.m, and he was sitting there eating, and I was eating, and I recognized him from his Ben Stiller show on MTV. And he recognized me because he had seen me do stand-up before. So I just went over and introduced myself, and we agreed that we kind of both liked each other's work and we'd like to work together. And then he got the deal at Fox and asked me to participate. So it worked out very well.
It must be really good for you as an actor to get a chance to play sketch comedy and try on all these characters for short periods of time.
Well, see, I'm not really an actor, and well, I guess you could say technically I am now because I have acted. But prior to the Ben Stiller show, I had not. And I had never done sketch comedy either. So as a stand-up, I guess if we rephrase that, as a stand-up, it was a great opportunity to do that. I mean, I had been offered other acting things prior to the Ben Stiller show and to the Larry Sanders show that I felt the scripts were bad. And then I had made a pilot a long time ago for CBS that made me realize I don't want to be an actor and I don't want to be in that end of the show business because it was just so bad, you know, and so much TV is so bad. So I waited and waited, and then these two opportunities presented themselves. So they, both Sanders and Stiller is a great part for anybody, you know, actor or comic or whatever that you do. So, but it was really my introduction to acting, so it was a good one.
My guest is Janine Garofalo. She co-stars in the film Reality Bites. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Comic and actress Janine Garofalo is my guest. In the stand-up of yours that I've seen, you have an image of someone who's not at all achievement-oriented, who's often broke. And it's interesting that you're actually getting pretty successful. So there's going to be a gap between that onstage persona and your real life.
Right. You know, the broke thing is not as prevalent, although I still don't have, you know, tons of cash. I'm certainly better off than I was. It's now going to have to be more concentrated on how, you know, personally how I feel like an underachiever or inept in certain ways or just whatever, you know. And it's not necessarily that that's my whole persona. It depends on sometimes what nights you catch me, you know, on my mood, because my act really can change quite a bit, you know, depending on whatever mood I'm in that day, or whatever I'm dealing with currently in my life. And right now, you know, I've had a series of, you know, with the earthquake, and the Friday before the earthquake, I got mugged, and then...
Did you? Wow, what happened?
Yeah, and then the Tuesday after the earthquake, my car got stolen. And so right now I'm just... And then the earthquake, you know, of course, threw everybody off. It's really a horrifying experience, and then all the aftershocks. So right now, when I do stand-up, it's really coming from a place of almost defeat. You know, I just feel defeated on some level by nature and by man here. So that's a tack I've been taking stand-up-wise for right now.
Gee, where'd you get mugged? What happened?
Oh, in front of my house. I was just getting out of my car, and these two guys ran at me, and they both had guns, and they just stuck them in my midsection and demanded my possessions. And they got my knapsack, which had, you know, obviously the wallet and the Filofax, which is your life. But they also got my diary, which really has really thrown me into a tailspin.
You probably got, among other things, a lot of your comedy from there.
Yeah, my diary's gone and my comedy notebook, which it's not like I really have my act written down verbatim, but there's many thoughts and ideas that I was working on.
Well, look, if you see
in that book,
if you see two guys with guns at the comedy clubs doing your act, you'll know who
stole
your
stuff.
Well,
I was just hanging. If you see two cholos bombing at the punchline,
yeah, really,
chain across this country, you know they're doing my act, since I basically bomb with it every time I use it. But
did you say anything when they had the guns poked in your stomach?
You know, I actually was smiling. I don't know why. It was surreal. I'd never even had a gun even waved in my direction before. The only guns I've ever seen have been on cops' belts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was surreal, and I was kind of smiling at them, probably out of nerves. And I just went, all right, relax, and I handed it over. And I don't know why it came out as laid back as that or why I was smiling, but it didn't seem real to me. And then when it sunk in that they not only got my wallet with all your credit cards and your driver's license and your bank card and you're now incredibly inconvenienced and your Filofax is gone, but to get my diary was very, very upsetting to me. So that was a drag.
It must be really disorienting for you when somebody like me assumes, like, well, you must be
so successful and so happening now, and you're feeling really defeated by these things that have happened to you.
Well, I am actually, nothing has changed for me. I'm no more successful, really, than before. I mean, I'm still just, you know, I did that movie and finished in August, and I go back to Larry Sanders in March. Other than that, nothing has changed, you know, and, you know, I haven't worked since August. I haven't been paid since August. You know, I don't work a lot, you know. I do stand up every once in a while, and I do these things, a couple of things. No one ever recognizes me, especially now. I have a short, like, yellow hair now. It's like orange yellow.
Well, I wouldn't recognize you if
right.
that's what your hair looks like. I'm used to long, dark.
Yeah, I used to have a lot of long black hair, which is now no longer. And so as far as that goes, the 0.5% of the population that would recognize me anyway now wouldn't with my hair yellow. And other than that, so nothing has changed for me. I mean, I still live in a studio apartment. I have no car. I have the same friends. I mean, nothing has changed. You know, I don't live any differently today than I did, you know, when I first moved here, except I have a little more of in the inner circle, people know who I am, you know, more so than they did maybe 4 years ago, and that's about it.
Why did your hair change?
Just no reason. I just was, I'd had long black hair for so long. I'd been dyeing it black and for like 10 years, and so I just, for some reason, cut it off and dyed it yellow. I mean, it looks horrible, but I don't mind, so I'll just leave it.
When were you able to give up day jobs?
Maybe 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, yeah.
What kinds of day jobs did you have during your years?
Everything.
I've
been fired from every day job I've ever had. I've been a bike messenger. I've answered phones in a health club. I did phone sex for a couple of days. I worked in a movie theater tearing tickets. I worked at Bloomingdale's in the tie department. I worked at the BU bookstore stocking books. I worked at a deli, but all these places I've been fired from. So I never have worked anywhere very long. I guess the longest job I ever had was a bike messenger or the movie theater.
Now, how are you fired from taking tickets at a movie theater, and how are you fired from phone sex?
Actually, the movie theater is the only thing I wasn't fired from. I take that back.
Okay.
I moved. Phone sex, I was fired because I couldn't bring myself to talk dirty enough. It embarrassed me, and these people that were calling were such losers that I was so profoundly depressed to know about the element that exists out there. Not that I didn't know about it, but being confronted with it in your ear hole on a daily basis is just very disheartening. And just the it's just more and more and more objectification of women that just gets hit home all the time in your ear. And I just couldn't be a party to it. So they have your boss listens in on your conversations, and when he realized that I was not towing the line with the sexual speak, I got canned, which was fine with me because I hated it.
Well, what did he tell you? What did he say?
He just said it's not working out. And I told him basically what I just told you, and he didn't care, and that's why I just left.
Do they give you tips before you start about what kind of language to use?
No, they just say do whatever it takes to keep him on the line for as long as you can.
What did you expect the job to be like?
I had just heard from other friends who did it about how much money you can make doing it, and you just go in and tune out and just do it. And I was not able to tune out, so I couldn't handle it.
Right. So how did you start doing stand-up?
Well, I had wanted to, when Letterman came on when I was in high school, I had just had a career thought that I wanted to be a writer for the David Letterman show because I was so inspired by that show. I thought it was so good. And then I went off to college with my, you know, lack of direction. I went to Providence College, which was some of the worst 4 years of my life, and met a stand-up comic named Steve, who I had a big crush on, and I would go watch him. And I decided from watching him that that's what I wanted to do, how I wanted to express myself, and started doing it when I was the summer before my senior year, I guess like 85, and just loved it, you know, and so I just never stopped.
You said the college was the worst 4 years of your life. What were so bad about those years? What was so bad about those years?
Awful. First of all, Providence College at that time anyway, 82 to 86, was the most conservative, short-sighted, small-minded, homogeneous yet homophobic campus. You know, it was this Catholic, just a real acid wash denim sports bar mentality, you know, if that makes sense. Just people that have never had strayed from the norm, never taken the road less traveled, anything, and they have no respect for anyone that does. And plus, I got really fat when I was there because I was so unhappy. And that is not a good way to be popular in college, is to be really fat and dye your hair weird colors and all of that. And the only respite I found, the only release I found was through like a there was like a really good kind of alternative music scene in Rhode Island at that time. So I would just go to clubs and I met people that way. So that was good. And I would hang out in Boston, you know, around the comedy scene. And that was the only release I got from the hell of the Providence College campus.
So you turned 30 this year, right?
On September 28th, I'll be 30. I turned 29 last birthday.
Is this going to matter to you one way or another?
No, I don't care. I don't care at all. The only thing that bothers me about, you know, getting older is just, you know, just personal things when I look in the mirror. But it doesn't bother me in the grand scheme of things,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. What bothers you when you look in the mirror?
Oh, I just, you know, the crow's feet and I just look bad. You know, I look older to myself, and there's something sad about that, I guess. It just looks bad.
How much older can you look? Don't you play 21 in your new movie?
I played 22 in that movie, and I when I saw the movie, I didn't think I looked 22. I mean, they cut my bangs real, real short to make me look younger. When I look at myself, though, you know, especially now that I have short yellow hair, I really see a 29-year-old. I mean, with all the days I've spent in the sun with baby oil on my face and all the cigarettes that have been smoked and just the living. Not that I mind, though. I mean, it is living. You make a choice to live your life. Are you going to get facials and wear moisturizer and drink 8 gallons of water every day? Are you actually going to live a life? You know, it's just a choice that you make.
Janine Garofalo co-stars in the film Reality Bites and in the HBO series The Larry Sanders Show. This is Fresh Air. We're in the middle of international crises in Bosnia and Israel. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We are trying our best to keep as up-to-date as we can on both stories. On the planes down in former Yugoslavia, as you know, Scott Simon is there, and we will be reporting. Also, we'll have some reports from the Pentagon and from the White House. In the Middle East, we're talking to people from the PLO about what their negotiating position is now, and we'll be hearing as well from Israel. This also is the first day of the Brady Bill. President Clinton is on the road, and we have a piece about a congressional staffer who wants to whistle for a living.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today, the last day of February, is also the last day of Black History Month. Commentator Gail Pemberton is on leave as Associate Director of the Afro-American Studies Department at Princeton University. She's been thinking about the evolution and significance of this month-long focus on Black history.
For the first time in I don't know how many years, I didn't make any appearances in conjunction with Black History, or if you prefer, African-American History Month. I'm on leave from my academic job and away from my regular haunts. I'm not complaining, it just felt out of the ordinary. Throughout the country, schools, churches, bank lobbies, bookstore windows, television and radio stations, civic centers, museums, colleges, theaters, and big businesses have worked overtime to stage special exhibitions this month to commemorate the contributions of African Americans to this country. I don't know what Carter G. Woodson, who was a founder of Negro History Week in 1926, would make of the current month-long celebration. Woodson and an impressive roster of African Americans, from writers Zora Neale Hurston and James Weldon Johnson to artist Aaron Douglas and theorist Alan Locke and many others, were the core of what we commonly call the Harlem Renaissance. It was a flowering of Black intellectual, political, and artistic expression, whether one thinks of it as a renaissance or not. As the nation's premier Black historian, Woodson was trying to make sure that the contributions and sacrifices of Black people to American culture did not get lost in the whirlwind of a soaring stock market or the haze of an F. Scott Fitzgerald jazz age. Half a century later, February is the month when African-American academics, artists, pundits, and successful business people and athletes find their phones ringing off the hook. The requests run from the sublime to the ridiculous, from novelists and poets reading their work to bookstore and mall exhibits replete with plastic-coated kente cloth doilies. And while it's important that we collectively recognize that African-Americans are part of the woof and warp of this country from at least as far back as 1620, we have to make sure that February isn't the only time we're interested in learning about it. The very effort to separate African-American contributions from our general history runs the risk of distorting things, of suggesting that black culture is marginal and able to be excised from the larger sphere of American history. It goes quite a bit beyond slam dunks and high fives. Anyone who's heard spirituals, or rock and roll, the blues and jazz, or listened to the rhythms of our vernacular speech, or read about our wars fought at home and abroad, isn't really going to understand any of it without considering the African-American component. So, I have a modest proposal. Why not make Black History Month the kickoff to a greater immersion into our collective American history? We could start very simply with birthday celebrations in black and white, adding greater ethnic variety along the way. In February, we could stage readings on the birthdays of Langston Hughes, Gertrude Stein, Toni Morrison, W.H. Auden, John Steinbeck, and W.E.B. Du Bois, as we gaze at Augustus Savage sculptures. We could relieve our tax woes on April 15th by listening to Bessie Smith, who was born that day, sing the blues. April 29th could be National Mood Indigo Day to commemorate the genius of Duke Ellington, with Zubin Mehta conducting. On August 1st, we could start reading Herman Melville's most famous book, Moby Dick, with its opening line of Call Me Ishmael, and the next day take on James Baldwin's Nobody Knows My Name. We could stage plays by Entezaki Shange and Wendy Wasserstein, who were both born on October 18th, and how about a Cab Calloway and Humphrey Bogart festival on Christmas Day? I would not abandon Black History Month. I'm afraid its demise would mean that African-American speakers would miss important opportunities to educate audiences, and many exhibits would go unseen. But as Langston Hughes once wrote, culture is a two-way street, and a more constant everyday inquiry into the relationship of black and white in this country would suit me much better.
Gail Pemberton is the author of the memoir, The Hottest Water in Chicago. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.